Robert Owens, an associate clinical professor in the Division of Pulmonary Critical Care and Sleep Medicine, University of California, San Diego School of Medicine, La Jolla, discusses the pathogenesis of obstructive sleep apnea from a physiologic perspective. Dr. Owens was recorded at the 24th Annual Advances in Diagnosis and Treatment of Sleep Apnea and Snoring, presented by the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine and the Penn Sleep Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Owens.
In the next 20 minutes or so, I'm going to go over the causes of sleep apnea. We're going to talk about, can we measure those causes in an individual? And then I'll show you some data on whether or not this would be a useful thing to do or not. So this is kind of the standard life cycle of an apnea or hypopnea. Many of you know this, but obviously obstructive sleep apnea starts with inadequate anatomy. Not a problem when we're awake. We have muscles and reflexes that keep the upper airway open. But when you go to sleep, you lose muscle tone, you lose the reflexes, and the airway closes. Once the airway collapses, different people have different amounts of respiratory effort, so they start struggling to breathe. And at some point, they're going to wake up from sleep. Okay, they're going to have an arousal. So what we've been focused on are the differences between people in terms of their anatomy, how much the muscles can be active during the night, how much people tolerate hypoventilation. So if you start to not get enough air, how do you respond to that? And then how easy or hard are you to wake up from sleep? So this for a long time has been our model of the pathogenesis of obstructive sleep apnea. And by our model, I'm talking about people like David White, Atul Malhotra, Andrew Wellman, and the Boston group. But basically you have sleep apnea because you have a small collapsible airway, you have really wimpy muscles, you have an unstable control of breathing or something called a high loop gain. This just means that if you have a little bit of hypoventilation, you have a big response. You want more air immediately. And then you wake up from sleep too easily. So I can't show you, as I said, any videos, but I want to do a little bit of a thought experiment of what happens when somebody goes to sleep and they don't get enough air. And this will kind of go through the concepts I'm talking about. So on the y-axis here, we have ventilation and ventilatory demand. And of course, our breathing system, it's a negative feedback loop. You always try to match your ventilation and your ventilatory demand. So you can think of ventilatory demand as trying to keep that PCO2 at 40 millimeters of mercury when you're awake, a little bit higher when you're asleep. So when you're awake, you match your ventilation and your ventilatory demand. But when you go to sleep, ventilatory demand goes down a little bit. PCO2 rises. If you're a normal person, you don't have sleep apnea, your ventilation falls a little bit as well, you're fine. The problem is when some people fall asleep, their ventilatory demand goes down, but their ability to get air through the upper airway goes down even more. So they're trying to breathe, but the upper airway is floppy. It starts to collapse. They can't get enough air in. Now, having bad upper airway anatomy doesn't condemn you to having sleep apnea. You may have really good muscles that can compensate. So you're going to fall asleep, you're not going to get enough air, and your ventilatory demand is going to go up, and it's going to stimulate the muscles of the upper airway. And maybe you'll get to an acceptable ventilation. So these might be people that have obstructive sleep apnea only during REM sleep when their muscles drop out. So this person has bad anatomy, but good muscles, they're able to achieve stable breathing. Unfortunately, not everybody has good muscles, just a fact of life. And so even though they build up more ventilatory demand at night, they don't achieve enough stable ventilation. So what's the problem? Why can't we just let people go longer and longer? They'll hypoventilate a little bit more, no problem. The problem is that at some point, your ventilatory demand gets so high, will be that PCO2, the negative intrathoracic effort to struggle to breathe, that at some point you reach something called the respiratory arousal threshold. You can't stay asleep and be struggling to breathe, and so you wake up from sleep. So this person has really wimpy muscles. They build up ventilatory demand, but they can't quite get their muscles to turn off enough before their arousal. The other factor that's important here is that concept of loop gain. Okay, and loop gain is basically the slope of this line, and it's how quickly the ventilatory demand increases for a change in ventilation. So we have a little bit of a ventilation gap here, and the ventilatory demand increases. So again, these are the factors we think are important for people at night: their anatomy, how good their muscles are, how quickly they build up ventilatory demand or loop gain, and how easy or hard they are to wake up from sleep with that arousal threshold. So if we had ways that we could increase the muscle function at night, we could maybe prevent sleep apnea, if we had ways to perhaps raise the arousal threshold at night, let somebody hypoventilate a little bit more but stay asleep, maybe we could prevent sleep apnea. And if we decrease the loop gain and didn't let people reach their arousal threshold, then maybe again we could treat somebody with obstructive sleep apnea. So these are kind of the concepts when we think about the pathogenesis of obstructive sleep apnea. I just want to get across that for some people, having sleep apnea is not just about having a fat neck. So can we measure these causes in an individual? And the short answer is that we can, generally through specialized research studies. And the way that we do that is by letting the airway collapse. So we bring people into our sleep laboratory, we put them on CPAP, and then we turn the CPAP down, and we induce hypoventilation, and we measure all the things I just showed you. So if you have a patient on CPAP, let's say 12 centimeters of water, we can measure how much air they'd like to have, what's their desired ventilation, and then as soon as we turn down the CPAP, their ventilation will go down, just like the example I gave you when they go to sleep. Also, like the example I just gave you, over time, they're going to build up a little bit of ventilatory stimulus, and we'll see how much ventilation they can buy back. You've seen this. As people go to sleep, you're reading a sleep study, they take a few very small breaths, and then some people are able to augment their ventilation. After about 3 minutes, we can turn up the CPAP level at the end, and we can see what was the ventilatory demand built up here, because now we turn up the CPAP, we can reveal how much their ventilatory drive was underneath this obstructed airway. So we can measure how much the anatomy is affecting things, we can see how much ventilation is bought back from the muscles, we can see what the ventilatory demand was here, so we can measure that loop gain term. Also, when we induce hypoventilation, sometimes the hypoventilation is so severe that people do arouse from sleep, and we can measure that arousal threshold. So again, the point is that we can actually measure these four traits in people in specialized research studies. At the end of the day, though, we can put together a plot that looks like this for each person with obstructive sleep apnea. And the point that I want to get across is that there are two lines here. This line is the achievable ventilation. This is what somebody can do in terms of their anatomy and what happens when they turn muscles on. And this is the desired ventilation or acceptable ventilation. So it starts out with how much air a person wants and how low they're willing to go in terms of their acceptable ventilation. And these lines cross, and there's an equilibrium point here. And if this point occurs before a patient wakes up, before their arousal threshold, then they won't have sleep apnea. But if this point occurs out here somewhere, then these lines never converge while the patient can stay asleep. And we'll go over a couple examples of this in a second. So again, we can measure the traits, put a model together which is very accurate at predicting whether or not a person will have sleep apnea. And as we'll show you later, different people have different models that look like this, and we can try to address the underlying causes here. The really good news for me in particular is that there are now automated ways that we could get some of these data without having to spend the night in the laboratory with a subject, trying to get them to sleep and adjusting their CPAP level. So Scott Sands at Brigham is really the one that's been doing this the most. And he now has several techniques where you can take a clinically ordered polysomnogram, fit a mathematical model to just the flow signals, and get all of the traits and measurements that I just mentioned. So I think this is really going to change how we do things in the future. I don't think it's starting right now, but I think in the next couple of years, we will have the ability to get quite a bit more information from a standard PSG than just the AHI. So again, there might be other causes of sleep apnea. We can measure them in an individual. Is that useful? How can this be modifying our practice going forward? So the first thing is that Danny Eckert, who's now in Sydney, Australia, published the results when we measured the traits in about 75 different people. And this is in the American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine in 2013. And there were some surprising findings. So as expected, people who have worse anatomy have more sleep apnea. So on the y-axis is a measure of anatomy called the P-crit, or the collapsing pressure of the upper airway. And people who are these gray dots on these figures will be people who don't have sleep apnea. So if you have a good anatomy, you don't have sleep apnea. If you have a bad anatomy, you can have an AHI up to 120. But unfortunately, kind of against our initial hypotheses, there was no difference in the muscles between people who have sleep apnea and people who don't have sleep apnea. There was no difference in that control of breathing, again, between OSA and control subjects. And the arousal threshold actually went the wrong way. So the people that had sleep apnea were actually those who were harder to wake up. So what's going on here? Were we just wrong? Was this years of, you know, effort wasted? And is it all about having a fat neck? I think a better model, we don't really use this anymore. I think initially we thought, okay, there are four different people who have sleep apnea and these are the problems. That's not really how we put things together anymore. And I think the way that we put things together now is a model that includes something called effect modification. And the idea here is that anatomy is really the primary problem with obstructive sleep apnea. And there are going to be people who their upper airway is always open. And if they have problems with loop gain or control of breathing, they're going to have central sleep apnea. And if they wake up too easily, they don't have obstructive sleep apnea, they're going to have insomnia. At the other end, there are people who their airway is always closed, and no matter what the other factors are, they will always have obstructive sleep apnea. But there's a range of people in the middle who have sort of a vulnerable anatomy, and things could go either way based on these other traits. So let me show you how that looks like here. So as I said, anatomy is the most important factor, and there's going to be people who have really bad anatomy. They're always going to have obstructive sleep apnea. So if your airway closes around atmospheric pressure, you'll almost always have sleep apnea. There are other people who will never have sleep apnea. But what I want to point out to you is that there are people in this vulnerable area where they have the same anatomy, and some people have an AHI of 1, some people have an AHI of 75. Okay, so what's different about these people? So now when you look at all those other factors that I just showed you, like the muscle function, control of breathing, and you get rid of the people who will always have sleep apnea or will never have sleep apnea based on their anatomy, then you start to see differences. So these are people that have the same range of anatomy, and now if you have bad control of breathing, you have OSA. If you have good control of breathing, then you're a control subject. Same thing with the upper airway muscles. Again, you focus on that group that has that vulnerable anatomy, get rid of the other people, and now if you have good upper airway muscles, you don't have sleep apnea, bad muscles, sleep apnea. So this is really our new model of how to put the physiology together. Anatomy is the most important thing, but these other factors are going to be important too for some people. So how big is this group of people who have vulnerable anatomy? So in this paper of Danny's, there were about 25% of people who their anatomy is so terrible, they're always going to have sleep apnea. But what was really interesting is about 1 in 5 subjects with OSA have a pretty good upper airway anatomy. Their sleep apnea is driven by something else. Most people had kind of, you know, about 60% of people had not great anatomy, but it was not so terrible that you couldn't think that they maybe would be treated with something other than CPAP. So is all this information useful? Is this model useful? And I think there are 5 different things that physiology could help with the management of obstructive sleep apnea. So first is the basic understanding of sleep apnea in an individual or group of people. Again, I showed you these diagrams, and it will take some thought to kind of think about what these diagrams mean. But again, this is one subject, and you can see they have sleep apnea because this equilibrium point is above their arousal threshold. But what I want to show you is that there's another subject. They're both these two subjects have the same AHI. AHI is exactly the same, 33 events per hour. But these two individuals look very different in terms of their traits. Right now, we bin all of the patients together who have severe sleep apnea as pretty much the same. I don't think we should do that. Now, a lot of work needs to be done here, but this at least gets to the underlying cause in an individual so that we could personalize treatment. You also could look at different groups of patients. So this is work that Brad Edwards did, where he looked at what sleep apnea looks like in younger patients with OSA versus older patients. There are differences here, mostly in anatomy and control of breathing. But there are some people here that may talk about obstructive sleep apnea and diseases like post-traumatic stress disorder, which is a hyper-aroused state. There's a very high prevalence of OSA and PTSD. Is it because these people all have bad anatomy, or is it something else like how well they can stay asleep? So I think there's really interesting work to be done here as well. When we started with this work, I think the idea was that you would find people who had a control of breathing problem and you would give them some treatment like oxygen or acetazolamide. If you had people who woke up too easily, you could give them a sedative hypnotic. We don't have great drugs that can turn the upper airway muscles on, maybe hypoglossal nerve stimulator, but of course that would be great. And there's been a number of papers which have shown many drugs which don't turn the muscles on at night, unfortunately. But this is a study by Danny Eckert where he gave Lunesta. And basically, if you looked at people who got Lunesta who had a low arousal threshold as one of their problems, they all showed improvement in their AHI from about 25 down to 11. If you gave Lunesta in a untargeted approach to people who didn't have a low arousal threshold, then there was no difference in the AHI and some people got much worse. I'm really interested. I think that, you know, of course, CPAP is very difficult for some patients. I'd love to know patients who I could reliably refer for surgery or for an oral appliance. And so I'm very interested in using the physiology to predict who's going to respond to one of those alternate non-CPAP therapies. This is a paper that we had in fall of last year where Sylvia Li is an ear, nose, and throat physician from Beijing, where we came up with a model using the underlying physiology to predict surgical outcome. I want to hammer this point home, though, that, again, these traits really depend on the anatomy. So what this figure is attempting to show is that if you have some intervention, like an oral appliance or surgery that moves the anatomy, it really depends where you start in terms of your anatomy. So if your anatomy is so terrible and you have an oral appliance that moves the anatomy, makes it a little bit better, again, these other traits aren't going to matter that I'm talking about. If you have an anatomy that's really good and you just need a small improvement to get out of the range of having sleep apnea, again, these traits won't matter. It's when you're in this vulnerable region where things like loop gain and arousal threshold do come into play. So in our particular model, if we used a statistical model, which largely your outcome from surgery and oral appliance, one of the main predictors is your pre-op AHI. If you have sort of a regular model, we had four different subjects who were all predicted to have an AHI of 20 to 30, which was a really bad prediction compared to their actual post-op AHI. When we included physiology in the model, we actually got a much better prediction here. I'll end with two things that I think are kind of new concepts but are pretty interesting. The first is whether or not your underlying physiology predicts adherence to CPAP. So again, Danny Eckert in Sydney has been writing about OSA in patients who are not obese. And what he's found, what their group reported, is that based on your weight class, that's linked with how many hours you use CPAP at night. He also found that these patients who had normal weight were those that had a low arousal threshold. So if you have someone who can't stay asleep very well and you're putting a mask on their face, are they going to have a tougher time with it than people who don't have sleep state instability? And the last thing I'll finish with, which I think is really interesting and trying to do some work on this now, is does physiology predict your symptoms of obstructive sleep apnea? So this is work by Li Xuan Yi, and I think Alan is on this paper as well, looking at different clusters of patients with obstructive sleep apnea. And I think we all see this in clinic. They identified three groups: the disturbed sleep group, so this is, you know, I have trouble falling asleep, staying asleep; the minimally symptomatic group, this is, you know, my wife says I snore and I'm told to come here; or those who are falling asleep at the wheel. So different patients experience sleep apnea differently. And I wonder if the underlying cause of their sleep apnea predicts how they experience sleep apnea. So the terminology I've been using is endotype and phenotype. This is an example. I think all of us realize that there are two different kinds of diabetes, for example. So we say diabetes, but some people have type 1, others are type 2 diabetics. I wonder if the different kinds of sleep apnea, so having a low arousal threshold, wake up too easily, these are the people that have the disturbed sleep OSA. And maybe we would treat them differently versus some of these other different kinds of sleep apnea. So again, I think physiology is, we're starting to get good ways to measure the traits in a relatively pain-free way off of clinical studies. I think physiology could help us understand the cause of sleep apnea in an individual or groups of people, may help us choose treatment for OSA, may help us risk stratify for success with non-PAP therapies. And then again, does your underlying physiology or type of sleep apnea predict adherence to therapy so you can really concentrate? You know, this person's going to have a tough time. I really need to follow them closely. And are your symptoms related to the underlying cause of physiology is something that we'll be looking at going forward.
There was one question. Is PCRIT really a measure of anatomy? Because it's not, A, it's not, you're not looking at the anatomy, and B, it's muscle function. There's a lot of factors that go into the PCRIT measurement. So how would you respond to that?
I guess I would respond that, yes, PCRIT is imperfect. You're right. I think we always talk about it as a measure of the passive anatomy, but if you look at it at REM versus non-REM sleep, it gets more passive. But I think it's a reasonable starting point, and I think you could do other measures of anatomy. All I would try to emphasize, as I was in my talk, is that whatever measure of anatomy or sort of functional anatomy, how much airflow you can get through the upper airway, that is not going to be destiny alone. There are these other factors that come into play.
Thank you, Dr. Owens. For information about upcoming CME activities from the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, visit meded.ucsf.edu/CME. And for information about upcoming CME activities from the University of Pennsylvania, visit penncmeonline.com.